TGSF 90.1, broadcasting live from up on Burnaby Mountain. At TGSF, we air public service announcements for not-for-profit community groups, organizations, and events. And we encourage you to submit a PSA and to please send it by email to cjsfpsa@sfu.ca. Be sure to include the details, like the name and contact information for the organization, date, time, location, and a short description of the event or service. Send your PSA information to cjsfpsa@sfu.ca.
We need to understand that Malcolm's greatness, that Malcolm's courage, and that his dignity is best served by living his creed, by living his legacy, by challenging the power, by fighting for freedom, by linking up with oppressed people, no matter where they may be, by fighting all systems of domination and exploitation, whatever their names are. In this way, we not only honor the life and legacy of Malcolm X, we honor the best democratic and liberationist traditions in ourselves.
That's Manning Marable, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Manning Marable, By Any Means Necessary, Malcolm X. The singular voice of Malcolm X speaks today to more people than ever before. He endures as a powerful and inspirational figure. It's not hard to understand why. With his mesmerizing oratorical style and cadence, it was Malcolm who redefined the discourse on race. He moved the discussion from notions of prejudice and discrimination to racism. It was Malcolm who articulated concepts like community control and white power structure and the field Negro and the house Negro. It was Malcolm who made it clear that blacks were the victims of a system of domination and exploitation that was not regional but national, not superficial but structural, not episodic but ongoing and intentional. His uncompromising critical analysis gave Malcolm his moral authority. He was assassinated on February 21, 1965. But as new generations discover him, his ideas live on. To talk about Malcolm X is Manning Marable. A renowned scholar, he was professor of public affairs, political science, history, and African American studies at Columbia University. His syndicated column, Along the Color Line, appeared in over 400 newspapers and journals around the world. He was the author of many books, including How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America. His masterwork, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, received the Pulitzer Prize. Manning Marable died in New York in 2011. This classic program was recorded at Metro State College in Denver in 1992 and is part of Alternative Radio's celebration of 30 years of independent broadcasting. And now, Manning Marable.
It's a real privilege to be with you today in marking the life of one of the most important single figures in African American and indeed American political and social history. Brother Malcolm X is more than simply a name in a history text. He's more than simply the most articulate spokesperson for black empowerment and for the humanity of African American people in the mid-20th century. He represents a model not only for his time, but for our time. The militant figure of Malcolm X has become rediscovered in the United States. And signs of that rediscovery, of that renaissance of interest in Malcolm, are everywhere. The leading black nationalist and political radical of the 1960s, Malcolm's image and words have been popularized in films and music videos, in posters, in poetry and political literature. Students on university campuses are now wearing, as we see in the audience today, caps and T-shirts and other paraphernalia of Malcolm X, and his uncompromising slogan, "By any means necessary." For many African American communities and college campuses, there are now hundreds of public forums and cultural events on May 19th to commemorate Malcolm X's birthday. Why the interest in Malcolm X? Some of the answers to the question come from Ron Daniels, the former director of Jesse Jackson's National Rainbow Coalition, who explains the interest in Malcolm this way. Malcolm X, Ron says, was an excruciating critic of America's system of virulent racism, oppression, and domination and class exploitation of Africa and the Third World. His voice is claiming renewed expression in a new generation that finds the continuing reality of racism, poverty, violence, and oppression of African people in America intolerable. Especially among young African Americans, there is an increased militancy, as Ron puts it, to fight the power. Malcolm's living symbol, his fighting spirit, therefore has become symbolic of a new degree of militancy and commitment and empowerment within the African American community. Now, much of the acclaim around the figure of Malcolm X has assumed a kind of cultural and uncritically cultural character, a tendency to turn a dynamic living activist into an abstract icon. Now, this is something that we as activists have to discuss and take seriously as a real problem inside of our movement and in our community. The same tendency has already happened to a much greater degree with Martin Luther King Jr., his ideological and political development frozen, as it were, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on that hot August afternoon in 1963 at the March on Washington, D.C. We praise and honor Martin Luther King Jr. for his "I Have a Dream" speech, but how many people who mark Martin's birthday in January also recall that Martin Luther King Jr. was one of the most trenchant critics against the Johnson administration's pursuit of the war in Vietnam? How many people forget the fact that when Martin died, he was organizing black sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee? How many people forget that when Martin Luther King Jr. died, he was charting a program that is a precursor to Jesse's vision of the rainbow, when Martin talked about the need for a poor people's march on Washington, D.C.? There is a regrettable tendency to turn our heroes into icons and to take away some of their legitimate activities that were a part of their personal and political biography, to freeze them at a stage of their development. Let us not do the same thing to Brother Malcolm X. Many people have asked me over the last 5 years that I've been working on Brother Malcolm, how did you go about reconstructing his life and trying to develop a perspective on what he did politically day by day? The answer is, in part, the difficulty in working on Malcolm is because there is no consolidated archive of Malcolm X. There is a plethora of funds for the reconstruction of the life of someone who was a mainstream leader, or even an African-American leader, whose development can be distorted in a way so that you lop off the more radical aspects of his development or her development. So like with Martin Luther King Jr., he's acceptable up until the time he gives the "I Have a Dream" speech. But the last 2 years of his life, well, let's forget about that. But with Malcolm, you can't forget about any of his development. And so what I found was that indeed the best single source, the best single repository of material on Malcolm X was actually accumulated by the FBI. We have over 2,200 pages of documents, of letters. And I want you to understand, for the conservatives in the audience, that how would you feel if you wrote a letter and you sealed it and put it in an envelope and mailed it, and somebody at the post office intercepted it, transcribed or Xeroxed your letter and mailed it on without your permission and without your knowledge, without a court order or a warrant? That's what they did to Malcolm X. We have dozens of speeches that have never been published or printed by Malcolm X that the FBI recorded. We've checked out their transcripts with those speeches that were recorded by the activists who were with Malcolm. Hey, their transcripts are better. They had better equipment. And the sad thing is that you paid for it. In reconstructing the life of an activist, as we go over the FBI material, as we look at the legacy, it allows us to see some of the damage that has been done and the deliberate efforts to minimize the legacy of Malcolm X. Some authors who popularized Malcolm X but wanted to freeze his development at a certain stage of his life have argued that his ideology really doesn't advance beyond his relationship with Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. And this interpretation ignores the fact that black nationalism is not a monolithic political ideology, but a spectrum of cultural, economic, and political positions which are grounded in the dynamics of black resistance to race and class domination in the United States and indeed throughout the African diaspora. The basis of African-American nationalism is the national identity and collective consciousness and experience of people of African descent in the United States, a consciousness of nationality which is at odds with the mainstream culture, ideology, society, and political values which are held by this system. The roots of this alternative national consciousness that we describe as black nationalism were established, the foundations of them, during slavery, under very difficult conditions, where African Americans were able to construct their own worldview, their own sense of family, their own culture, and their own rituals of dignity and pride in who they were as human beings. In summary, black nationalism as a political and social tradition would include certain characteristics. First, the advocacy of black cultural pride and the integrity of the group, which implicitly rejects racial integration. Second, an identification with the image of Africa, which includes the advocacy by many of immigration, or at least extensive contacts between Africans abroad and at home. There must be an interaction, black nationalists would advocate, between African Americans, people of African descent in the Caribbean, and Africans on the continent of Africa itself. Third, black nationalism means the construction of all black social institutions, such as self-help agencies, schools, and religious organizations, and the support for group economic advancement, such as black cooperatives, by black campaigns, and efforts to promote capital formation within the African American community. Finally, black nationalism has also meant historically political independence from the white-dominated political system and support for the creation of all black political organizations and protest formations. Black nationalism has a very rich tradition and heritage in the black freedom struggle. And indeed, if one opens a book on the history of black people in the United States, there is a great deal of information about integrationism. There's a great deal of information about the tradition, which is still a very viable tradition, of the NAACP, of the Urban League, of civil rights organizations. But what we miss is the truth about the black experience. Because the truth about the black experience is, as Du Bois once put it, that people of African descent in this country are indeed Americans in the sense that we were born here, in the sense that we fight for full democracy and civil rights here, in the sense that we fight against any barrier that defines us as second-class human beings. In that sense, yes, we are indeed involved in a fight for civil rights and social justice. But we are also people of African descent. We are also people who have a cultural, aesthetic, and social and political connection with the broader African world. And what Malcolm stood for was that tradition of black nationalism. And anyone who interprets Malcolm and says that he repudiated that tradition, anyone who says that Malcolm turned his back to black nationalism by the end of his life, that is simply incorrect. It's wrong. It's not supported by the evidence. Malcolm X was a black nationalist, first, last, and always. That was the legacy of Malcolm. Now, it's crucial to note that there was always an internal ideological split and tension within this black nationalist tradition that I just outlined for you. There were always, from all the way back to the mid of 19th century, conservative black nationalists who tended to emphasize certain kinds of political positions, such as strict racial separatism, a distrust of dialogue or alliances with progressive white formations. They emphasized African cultural values and supported frequently private market economic mechanisms for group advancement. In other words, they advocated a kind of black capitalism. These were the more conservative black nationalists. Now, there was also a more radical black nationalist tradition. The revolutionary black nationalists were inclined to be very critical of capitalism and said that capitalism as an economic system coming out of Europe, an economic system becoming ensconced in the United States and its tentacles through corporate America going across the world, strangled the possibility of black liberation and black development. And so they tended to be very critical of capitalism. Secondly, more revolutionary black nationalists tended to advocate a more radical version of Pan-Africanism. They said, yes, we are an African people, and we can unite culturally with our sisters and brothers abroad, but we should also unite politically with them in overthrowing imperialism, overthrowing Western colonialism. So they interpreted black nationalism in a more radical way. Both are parts of black nationalism, but they are two different kinds of sub-traditions within one overall movement. And finally, radical black nationalists recognized that institutional racism has evolved in direct conjunction with the development and maturation of capitalism in the Western Hemisphere over the last four centuries, that it provides the ideological and cultural justification for the continued exploitation and oppression of black people wherever they may be. So therefore, the revolutionary nationalists said, it is not enough to fight against racism. You also had to denounce capitalism as well. Now that I've given you this background to black nationalism, we understand the tradition. We understand the tensions within that tradition between conservative and more revolutionary black nationalism. Now let's discuss the evolution of Malcolm X. And Malcolm's trajectory will begin to become clear to you. The Nation of Islam was the dominant black nationalist formation during the period after the Garvey black nationalist movement of the 1920s through the black power upsurgence of the 1960s. So to begin talking about Malcolm, we've got to talk about the Nation of Islam. Born in Detroit's African-American neighborhoods during the Great Depression, his creator and first prophet was an obscure salesman. the Honorable W.D. Ford, after preaching for 4 years, an ideology which was a mixture of Sunni Islam and black nationalism, Ford succeeded in recruiting to his cause about 8,000 converts by the middle of the 1930s. He established the Fruit of Islam, a paramilitary organization, the Muslim Girls Training Class, a school specifically for women members of the nation, and the University of Islam. After Fard's disappearance or death, his chief lieutenant, Elijah Muhammad, became the leader of this religious and black nationalist movement. Now, during the 1930s, a number of people in the nation fought for leadership with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And so Elijah Muhammad moved his organization and the basis of his support from Detroit to Chicago by the early 1940s. Now, at this point, an event took place that greatly accelerated the development of the Nation of Islam. Muhammad was convicted and imprisoned unjustly during World War II for resisting the draft. Now, while he was a federal prisoner in a federal penitentiary, Elijah Muhammad looked around him and began to realize that African-American churches, the NAACP, and Urban League, the other civil rights organizations, made no efforts to recruit the most oppressed, the most victimized of all African-American people. And these are the black prisoners. And so it was Elijah Muhammad in his genius that he recognized that there was no program to recruit and to transform the most oppressed of his race, those who were addicted to narcotics, pimps, convicts, young delinquents, prostitutes, the permanently unemployed, and the undereducated. During this post-war period, the Nation of Islam began to focus on the most oppressed African-American group, and the results were astonishing. By 1960, the nation's membership was between 65 to 100,000 nationwide. During Elijah Muhammad's tight discipline and his pro-black nationalist creed, thousands of people addicted to drugs quit their dependence on narcotics. People who had been oppressed, people outside of jobs, people outside of hope, found a sense of humanity, a sense of human dignity by joining the Nation of Islam. Over three-fourths of the nation's members by 1960 were young African Americans between the ages of about 18 to 35. Members donated a significant portion of their personal income, as much as one-third of their annual income, to the nation, which was used to construct Islamic schools, temples, and businesses. In Chicago alone, by 1960, the Nation of Islam owned $500,000 worth of real estate. The nation's expansion during the 50s was also largely attributable to Elijah Muhammad's recruitment of a most gifted and very charismatic spokesperson named Malcolm Little. Malcolm Little was converted to the Nation of Islam while he was in prison. He had been a petty hustler, a criminal, in Boston and New York's ghettos. Leaving prison in 1952, Malcolm Little was renamed Malcolm X, the X symbolically repudiating the white man's name which he had carried. Elijah Muhammad carefully nurtured Malcolm X's career into the organization's hierarchy. By 1955, Malcolm had become the minister of Harlem's Temple No. 7. He increasingly, in the late 50s, began to travel throughout the country. An articulate spokesperson and orator, as Aaron was to Moses, in a sense, in delivering what he believed to be the truth to liberate his people. Political leaders began to relate to the Nation of Islam, recognizing that Elijah Muhammad's absolute control over so many thousands and thousands of potential voters represented an important political power block. So Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the most prominent black elected official during this period, attended a leadership conference staged by Malcolm X in Harlem in 1960. Fidel Castro, the same year, met with Malcolm for private political discussions. Simultaneously, unknown fully to Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X, the Federal Bureau of Investigation made the decision to thoroughly infiltrate the Nation of Islam. They had already had agents in the organization since the 1940s. But what is very clear is that as the nation began to grow, as it began to assume a great deal of leadership, not just over 100,000 people, but over several million African Americans who looked to the nation with respect, that is when the FBI made the decision to infiltrate in a very sophisticated manner. The Nation of Islam's temples were wiretapped. They were wiretapped illegally. No court orders. The FBI doesn't worry about legality. The Nation of Islam's members began to be watched. Their taxes began to be looked at. Malcolm's letters in 55 and 56 were seized in the mail, transcribed, and sent on by the FBI. All illegal. This is all illegal. By 1960, the surveillance on Malcolm began to accelerate dramatically. And so you have a number of agents who are just specifically charged in various headquarters to follow and document the movements and statements of Malcolm X. Now, as the Nation of Islam prospered, white liberals and black integrationists became fearful of the movement's stunning success in attracting working-class African-Americans and low-income people. Scholars studied the nation and drew parallels. They said, between the Nation of Islam and the rise of fascism in Europe, white sociologist Gordon Allport described the nation as, quote, the hate that hate produced. A racial cult similar, he argued, to, quote, Hitler and the white citizens' councils of the South. A black sociologist and writer, C. Eric Lincoln, in Black Muslims in America, this social philosopher expressed the concern that, quote, the black Muslims' virulent attacks on the white man might threaten the security of the white majority and lead those in power to tighten the barriers which already divide America, unquote. Civil rights leaders began to speak out against the Nation of Islam. In August 1959, Roy Wilkins, then the head of the NAACP, declared that the Nation of Islam had a, quote, white hate doctrine, which was as dangerous as any group of white racists. The Nation of Islam clearly, quote, furnishes ammunition for the use of white supremacists. James Farmer of CORE denounced the nation as, quote, utterly impractical and dangerous. Farmer argued, and I quote, after the black culture was taken from us during slavery, we had to adopt to the culture here and adapt to it. So Farmer, by rejecting integration, Farmer reasoned, the Muslims were in effect aiding and abetting the dynamic of racial segregation. But with a surer grasp of African American history, Malcolm X responded to Farmer this way. He said, quote, we who are Muslims, followers of Elijah Muhammad, do not think that an integrated cup of coffee is sufficient payment for 310 years of slave labor in America. Malcolm understood that there was something fundamentally flawed with the philosophy of liberal integrationism if being an integrationist meant you wanted to integrate with the mainstream. Well, if the mainstream was racism, if the mainstream was capitalist exploitation, if the mainstream was all kinds of ideologies which were backward and anti-human, why would you want to integrate with a sewer? This is what Malcolm argued. Malcolm argued, it is not a case of dark mankind wanting either integration or separation. It is a case of wanting freedom, just